From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Denez Lehane writes crime fiction that is very gritty and somehow beautiful, lowdown and literary. He's rooted in Boston but lives in L.A. now. His latest book goes to World War II-era Florida, to old Tampa, and on to Cuba. It follows notorious gangster now-turned-consigliere Joe Coughlin as he discovers there's a contract out on his life. This hour On Point, we're talking with writer Denez Lehane. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Joining me now in the studio is Denez Lehane, best-selling author. His latest novel is World Gone By. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. His books have become big Hollywood blockbusters, Mystic River, Gone Baby Gone, Shutter Island. He wrote the film The Drop, which came out in the fall. Staff writer for the third and fourth seasons of HBO's The Wire. He also wrote for and produced on HBO's Boardwalk Empire. Denez Lehane, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
L.A. is home these days, out of your Boston town here.
Yes.
Because Hollywood is taking up so much of your time?
Yes, there was that, yes. And then my wife and children decided they really liked it. So
because it's
the
warm,
1 year experiment turned into something else. Yeah.
What does that do to the kid, the guy, the man, the writer, famously from Boston, when it's time to turn on the writing? Does it flow the same in L.A. as it does if you're writing in Boston or Florida, for that matter?
Maybe more powerfully, but just because I'm so incredibly homesick that it makes me recreate the world, I think, even more vividly.
Just dreaming it, seeing it in your mind's eye,
yeah.
Looking back on it.
Yeah, Hemingway, I remember I was in a movable feast. Hemingway said that he wrote well about Paris when he was in Michigan. He wrote well about Michigan when he was in Key West, and on and on and on.
Can I ask you, the last time we talked, it was about the Boston Marathon bombing.
Yeah.
And this is
yep.
a story that the whole country, the whole world's really paying attention to. The trial, of course, going on in Boston now, and new insights coming out as evidence is presented there. In the last week, we saw when Jahar Sanaya was trapped in a boat in a town just next to Boston after the big chase there. And, of course, it was discovered he was riding on the inside wall of this boat. And then the police come. The fiberglass wall of the boat is full of bullet holes and all the rest with blood streaming down. Looks like a crime writer's scene, if I ever see one. It's on the table right between us right now. What do you think of this image of the boy in the boat after this bombing, writing on the wall, you know, the U.S. government is killing our innocent civilians, but most of you already know that. As a Muslim, I can't stand to see such evil go unpunished. You know, you hurt one of us, you hurt us all. At least that's how Muhammad wanted it to be. You're a Boston guy. You're a crime writer. Here's blood dripping down the wall of a boat. What do you think of that kind of message?
Well, he strikes me as a... as the real question mark of all of it, because he's there's a vacuousness to him. There's a
stoner slacker.
And also just I don't think I don't think any of his ideas are original. I think he's a mimeo of his brother, and a very pale mimeo of his brother. So it's hard to kind of lock on to this kid. And he seems to have also these attributes we complain about in the millennials. Mm. You know, he seems there's no there kind of thing. Mm. And there's this weird sense of entitlement that's and incredible narcissism that's connected to it as well. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe that he believes any of this, except in the way that when you're – you know, when you're a 15 or 16-year-old kid, you globalize everything.
Yeah.
You globalize your own narcissism. You know what I mean? So I think that's why I've been thinking about this case a lot recently, because I was approached about a project connected to it. So I've been thinking about it a lot. And the older brother seems to have been, in his own deluded way, at least there was this weird, extremely misguided, but there was this weird principle at the core of him where I think he believed what the kid's writing here.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think the kid believed it at all.
It's interesting because you are, in effect, making exactly the defense case here. They'll want to put you on the stand. They're saying he's guilty, he helped with this, but don't put him to death. Don't go to the death penalty because he was just kind of a sock puppet for his older brother.
Well, I'm going to make a really weird distinction here. I don't believe in the death penalty. However, I don't think that if you were trying this kid for death or not, I don't think that's any defense at the end of the day. You know, my brother made me do it. No, you did it. You blew up those kids. You killed that poor child. You amputated all those limbs. You did all that damage. I don't care what your reasoning was at the end of the day. You did it. You acted. So I don't feel that that's – I would be a good witness for the defense at the end of the day.
You've been approached with a project on this, you say. I mean, everything seems to become fodder these days for, you know, TV or movies.
Yeah.
And often to great effect. We learn from the way – we talked with John Ridley yesterday.
Sure.
He's got American Crime, did 12
yep.
Years a Slave. And, of course, Ferguson and everything going on now. And he's treating a lot of those issues in his stuff. What do you think about the – the role that television films are, it seems to me, maybe coming more and more, or at least in shorter, quicker cycles to play in digesting what we see going on in the world.
And that's part of what I'm grappling with, even as I consider or lean toward or lean away from this project, is it too soon? You know, have we processed it correctly yet?
Is it looking at the Boston bombing in particular or terrorism?
The Boston bombing in particular.
Wow.
So
that's a tough call. How do you think about what's too soon?
It's something. These are conversations. I just had a conversation with a friend about it. These are issues that I'm grappling with. When is it? Is there any even the slightest possibility that the project could in any way be exploitative? Then I don't want any part of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's the thing.
I mean, people are just getting out of PT. Some of them physical therapy.
Exactly.
Maybe not even still.
Exactly. I met several. It was a very humbling experience. I went to a Red Sox game with a bunch of friends, and somebody recognized me. This is a year ago,
mm-hmm.
and they took me up to meet a few of the victims who were there at the behest of Dustin Pedroia, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such a humbling experience to meet anybody who was truly victimized by this, directly victimized by this tragedy. So I don't know yet if I've processed it or got my head around it to the point where I could do the job.
As a crime writer, as a writer, you think a lot about motivation, whether it's for your novels, and many of them, or the films, or TV. Think with us for a second about the motivation of, let's say, these two brothers, the Sarnaya brothers in the marathon bombing, but not just them.
Right.
The ranks of ISIS, the Islamic State, have been swollen by people coming from the UK, from France.
Yep.
We've seen the images just in the last few days of those teenage girls running away from home to become Islamic State brides. There is a magnet that is pulling here.
Yep.
What do you think of that?
I think there's a lot of transference going on.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is if you look at and help me if I'm not pronouncing this correctly because I don't listen to news. Is it Tamerlan?
Yes.
Okay.
The older brother.
So
the
older brother Tamerlan. Here he is. He has pursued the American dream very, very hard with extreme discipline on one hand to become a boxer.
Mm-hmm.
And then that door gets shut in his face.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't work out.
It doesn't work out. So now this is a guy who was simultaneously grown up to feel entitled. He was grown up to feel as if he were, you know, the firstborn, the golden child.
Yeah.
He never has to work. He just has to pursue this dream.
Yeah.
The dream gets shut in his face.
Mm-hmm.
His mother, right around that point, who has been fluffing him up and fluffing his ego up for many years, she disengages from the culture.
Yeah.
And their response to why it didn't work out is not to look inward. It's to look outward. It's to say we were shut out and then to do transference and to say, well, then this is an issue of I need to embrace a deeper meaning in my life. I will take on radical Islam or maybe Islam, which then leads to radical Islam. What you're finding over and over in a lot of these cases is that sense of the person feeling shut out of the society in which they are supposed to exist. So it's almost like they're on the outside of the window looking in.
But a lot of would-be boxers fail.
I know. Oh, I know that. No, I'm not making this.
All of them.
Oh, I'm not making this as an A plus B equals C.
I get it. And yet, I mean, it's Tamerlan. It's his little brother to some extent.
Absolutely.
There's something, I don't know, 5,000, 7,000 who have gone from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in all these cases, it's easy to imagine that some version of his story is going on in a lot of them. What's the answer to that?
I don't know what the answer is. I truly don't. I mean, I wish I were a head of state and I had some sense. But what we're seeing, without a doubt, what we're seeing is a deep, deep-seated disenfranchisement that is going on, I would say, an alienation.
You write about gangsters in your new book, World Gone By. Something similar there to Americans who joined gangs back in the day?
Oh, yeah, they weren't. It's the great Do you ever remember the terrific tracking shot from Goodfellas in which he goes into the Copacabana?
Yes, of course.
Okay, so yeah. Now the point of that tracking shot, if you study it from a cinematic standpoint, mm-hmm. is that it's the immigrant experience. Mm-hmm. That they come in through the back door. They go in underneath yeah. the underbelly.
Down
then they go
and, down
up,
and dirty. Yeah.
Then they go up,
and
then they ascend, and then the table is placed for them at the front of the line.
Yeah.
That's basically...
That's the dream.
That's the dream. But the point being that very few disenfranchised or immigrant classes have yeah. ever come into this country or any yeah. country that I know of
yeah.
and have just immediately come straight to the door.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way because there's too many barricades.
Your own family, parents, yeah. Irish immigrants.
Yep.
With plenty of conflict back in the old country.
Absolutely.
It's not exactly Syria or Islamic
no.
State, but there was plenty of tension and spillover and awareness that even as they struggled here.
Absolutely. And they're not so much my parents' generation, but the generation of Irish immigrants who came before them
mm-hmm.
dealt with a staggering amount of prejudice, dealt with a staggering amount of being blocked out, disenfranchisement. And so they had to create, in a sense, their own gang. Look at what Boston is. Boston was created by the gang who said, well, we can't deal with the Brahmins, so we're going to create our own world.
That gang and its story go all the way to Florida, Tampa, all the way to Cuba, in a way, in Dennis Lehane's new book, World Gone By. We'll talk about it. Dennis, it's great to have you right here. Please stand by. Little theme from Mystic River, Clint Eastwood's treatment of Dennis Lehane's novel of the same name. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with gritty crime writer Dennis Lehane, son of Boston, with feet in Florida and L.A., about American life now and his latest novel, World Gone By. It's set in Tampa in World War II, a world of gangsters and old Cuba, blood and betrayal. Dennis, we've got callers for you already. Just we'll go to this new novel. It's a really interesting, but just maybe a call or two on the whole issue of the Boston Marathon bombing, the trial there. Josh in Buffalo, New York. Josh, you're on with Dennis Lehane.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I personally think, and I think that I hold the views and the values of all Americans, this person is generally guilty. It's documented. We've seen it.
They've said it in court. They said he did it.
Yeah.
Right. We're wasting our time with all this court stuff and whether he should be put to death and blah, 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 blah. I think that if you poll every person that was injured in that bombing, they would agree with me. They don't want him put to death. He's getting the easy way out. He should be sentenced to the worst prison in the United States and left there. No possible parole, nothing. And again, if you pull 100 people and you ask them, hey, can we add an extra dollar to your tax bill every year so we can pay for this guy to rot in prison? Every single person in the United States of America is going to say, absolutely.
Josh, we've got it. We've also got a jury system. Dennis, how do you look at this issue of life in prison or death? Those seem like the alternatives here. How do you look at it?
Oh, I've just never believed in the death penalty. It's just not something I'm.
And why not? With all your experience thinking about the world of crime.
Well, because I think that a prison sentence is plenty bad, but I also think that if you study there's no other way to put it. When a rich white man gets the death penalty, is the day I'll believe in the death penalty.
And that does not happen too often.
It never does. It never does. It's not too often. We can't put it that
mm-hmm.
way. It is unequivocally never happened. So the day it happens, then I'll open up the discussion.
Take us to the world of your new novel, World Gone By. This
yep.
is a part of a now trilogy.
Yep.
It started in early 20th century Boston, a big police strike there with
yep.
the ancestors of the same main character you've got now in Tampa. Take us through this trilogy a little bit. Set the stage for the World Gone By.
Well, World Gone By, it was really... It's part, again, of a triptych, I kind of think of
mm-hmm.
it as looking at the world between the wars, America between the world wars. The first one begins on Armistice Day,
mm-hmm.
and this final one ends in the middle of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a way to just look, I think, at a movement from America as it gradually lost some innocence, but also as it was moving towards becoming a superpower and making both the mistakes and some of the doing some of the beautiful and wonderful things that it did as a country, as it morphed from a very isolationist and it was a successful country, but it was not a superpower to becoming a superpower. And I just wanted to look at that time period.
Introduce us to Joe Coughlin, whose family, father, grandfather are there in the very first book in this triptych, as you put it, in the Boston police strike, 1917?
1919 was the Boston police strike, September 1919. His father was a police captain, an extremely esteemed police captain. Joe grew up with all the sort of trappings of a successful political family, which is what his father represented. But he also grew up seeing the hypocrisy behind it. He was the son of a loveless marriage. He was able to see that his father was actually quite corrupt, and it gave him a lifelong dislike for both authority and the sort of the trappings of the state, if you will.
The second edition in that triptych, where does it take Joe?
It takes Joe to Tampa because Joe ends up becoming a gangster in the 1920s during Prohibition. And what he gets involved with is rum. And rum came into the United States from Cuba primarily. And a lot of it came into the West Central Florida, Tampa, specifically a part of Tampa called Ybor City. Mm-hmm. So Joe becomes in the second book a sort of kingpin of the rum trade. By the third book, we pick up with him in World Gone By. He is older. He is he's 37. He's a widower. He's got a 10-year-old son. And he is at this point at the peak of his powers. He's a consigliere. He moves easily between the Tampa underworld and the upper echelons of Tampa society. He's a golden boy. And that's when he starts hearing this whisper that somebody is planning to assassinate him.
It is not news to people in Tampa that they've got this rum-running gangster history. I mean, looking at your interviews with people in Tampa, this is well-known. Yeah. Why Tampa? Why not? I don't know. Why wasn't it Key West? Why wasn't it Miami? Why wasn't it?
Because I love Ybor City. Ybor City is a part of Tampa. If Boston and New Orleans had a baby, it would be Ybor City. It's red brick and wrought iron, and it's right on the water, and it's absolutely beautiful. It was a very Casablanca vibe. This was Tampa gangland. It was also a community filled with very proud, hardworking cigar workers who were Cuban, mostly African American and Italian American. And this was at a point in their lives. I mean, this is a point in our history in which those groups were not allowed to mingle with white America. And so they were pushed and kept in Ybor City, and they were forced to form their own community, which they did. And it was this wonderful community filled with, again, gangsters, revolutionaries, very hardworking cigar workers, union organizers, everybody all in this great melting pot in this one little tiny pocket of Tampa.
And it really tied Tampa, Florida, into Cuba, especially, as you say, the rum running, the gangsters. You've got appearances in World Gone By of real-life gangsters, Meyer Lansky and Santo Trafficante and Carlos Marcello. I mean, they're in here alongside your fictional gangsters.
Yes, they are, yeah.
Are they your models, or do you go in a different direction?
No, I wanted to – basically, if you knew the history of the Tampa mob, this is when Trafficante would have already been in power. But I have it – I just bumped the years a little bit. So it's just before Trafficante came into power. And Joe is my – is my model. Joe and the Bartolo family are my fictional beachhead of what would have been there.
So what's your guy's character, Joe Coughlin? How would you describe it?
Joe is he's exceptionally smart and charming. He's also emotionally would be extremely amputated. Like most gangsters, he doesn't have much self-awareness. Like most of us, he thinks of himself as the hero in his own narrative. He thinks he's a good guy. Mm-hmm. He doesn't think he's a great guy, but he doesn't realize that he's actually pretty much a very bad guy.
And he's still got at the fancy party, he's still got the Derringer in his back belt.
Exactly, and he's just one tick away from realizing that the sins of his past are coming home to roost. But that one tick is a big tick.
There's almost always a moral quandary at the heart of your books. What is it this time?
Well, a good part of it would be how does he raise a child in this world? How could he possibly do that? Because as the book progresses, he starts to realize that the true victims of this lifestyle are the wives and the children whose lives are, as he puts it at one point, families, we always say families are sacred, but we sure
in the gang world.
But we sure do amputate a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know? So that's the realization that is trying to press in on him. But you can't do this life unless you have an amazing ability to deflect.
Yeah.
So he's constantly
boxed things
off. He's almost
off
like bulletproof against the truth. He's constantly deflecting it.
Dennis Lehane's new novel is World Gone By. He's with me in the studio today. Talk of Ben Affleck. Is he working on this triptych, on this book or the predecessor?
He's
for
working
a movie?
On Ben is set to direct. He's already written the script. He's set to direct and star in Live by Night.
The
second one.
The second book. In the series.
Yeah, the first in the series, The Given Day, that's not for sale. Right.
Yeah. Not for sale.
Not for sale.
What do you mean by that?
I don't want it to be a movie. I think the only way it could ever be anything would be long-form television, like a miniseries.
Uh-huh.
And
because it would be have too much cut out to make
yes,
a movie?
Yes. It's meant to be this sprawling. You're meant to be immersed in this
Thorn
world.
Birds.
There's not one storyline in The Given Day. There's like seven that matter. And it's a portrait of a time, and it's a portrait of a period, and it's a portrait of social fabric. And so I want – the only way I would allow it, and I would be in charge anyway, the only way I would allow it would be as television.
I want to talk about how all that works, but listeners want to talk with you. Greg in Somerville, Massachusetts. You're on with Dennis Lehane. Thank you for calling, Greg.
Hi, Tom. Thanks, guys, for taking my call. I'm big fans of you both. So to both at the same time is pretty special for me. My question is about your books, Dennis. I've read them all. I love them. And you never, ever can cease to stop shocking me. I mean, I think I have you figured out. I think I know where you're going with something. And then you throw a curveball, and it happens every time. How do you do that? Where does it come from, if you wouldn't mind?
Oh, sure. Thanks, Greg. It probably comes from me being a reader myself. So I start to ask myself, okay, where do I think I'm going? Where would a reader think I'm going?
Mm-hmm.
And my job at the end of the day is, I really take this seriously, is in the best possible sense of the word, is to entertain. And so if I'm just doing paint by numbers and I'm not giving you a rich surprise by the end of a book that is promising that, that's not – The Given Day doesn't promise any surprises, so I could do whatever I wanted there. But if I'm taking you down the path of like a Shutter Island – then I owe it to you to knock your socks off at the end. I mean, I think that's kind of my job. So what I keep doing is saying to myself, would you be fooled? Would you be fooled? Would you be fooled?
Mm-hmm.
And if I keep answering no, then I say, all right, I got to go deeper.
When do you know what the curveball is going to be? Do you know it before you begin? Have you already scribbled that out on the back of a napkin, or it comes to you as you wade in?
A lot of times it just comes to me as I wade in. It's most books for me are very organic processes. I might know one thing that happens. I know three things usually that happen in a book, but this is World Gone By is a perfect example. When you get to the ending, realize that was never the ending. It was not the ending until I'd written four failed drafts. And I said, what is the problem here? And then I finally zeroed in on the last few pages of the book and said, this is wrong. This is all a lie. It's not true to what the book itself is saying. It's true to what I want the book to say, which is a very different thing.
Greg, thanks for your call. Lisa,
thanks, Greg.
In Medway, Massachusetts. Lisa, you're on.
Hey, Dennis. It's your old friend from Medway.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. Dennis, I was wondering, I see you a lot, especially as you've evolved, in the tradition of the great Catholic novelist Flannery O'Connor, who used violence also to great and startling effect. And so I wondered if you could comment on kind of the role of kind of faith and violence and your Catholicism as part of that. And, you know, do you see yourself in some ways in that tradition of what we think of as kind of explicitly Catholic writers?
Great question.
I don't know if I'm an explicitly Catholic writer, but I do consider myself a Catholic writer. I'm not sure I consider myself a Catholic anymore, but I do consider myself a Catholic writer. And when I look at that tradition, I look at the short story writer Flannery O'Connor. I look at Walker Percy.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the films of Martin Scorsese. That's what my questions are very much about when I'm writing is there a God? What kind of God would he be or she? And what is our expectation? What are we expected to do in a world that either has one, doesn't have one, or has a certainly an inactive one? So these are what I would consider Catholic questions that I'm often asking. I don't know that I sit down every book and say I'm going to write something very Catholic. I do know with World Gone By that there is a sermon in chapter 4, I believe. They go to church in the fourth chapter. And I knew in that moment, I said, this sermon is laying the groundwork for the entire book. And so I was more aware in World Gone By of writing a Catholic book, I think, than I've been in any book since Mystic River.
Talk about the geography of that awareness. You're a Boston kid, very Catholic terrain, college in Florida. And of course, this is set in Florida, in Tampa, not where you went to college, but close enough. And then you take it on to Cuba. These are all rather Catholic settings, particularly in this time frame, the 1940s.
40s, yes.
Different flavors of Catholicism? Or are you even thinking about that level of religious atmosphere? Or as you think about it, Boston Catholicism versus Florida's versus Cuba's?
Well, there's a very strong the church in which the Joe attends is a famous church in Tampa, it's the Sacred Heart, and I imagined, as we now are in the days of very empty pews, I imagine what
today not the 1940s,
and I imagine what would that church have looked like in 1943.
Yeah.
And the simple fact is it would have been packed to the rafters. I actually did some research on how many people it could have held and how many people would have gone to services in the 1940s. And the world is at war. The Catholic Church is in its zenith as a power in American culture. And everybody would have been showing up, question.
But it's really Spanish Catholicism that you'd see there versus Irish.
It would have been Italian Spanish.
Oh, Italian. Yes. Well, of course, in this church, in your gangland arena, different feeling from Boston Catholicism that
I didn't feel like it was. I don't know why. There's something about when you drive past the church, it resembles my wife's from just outside of Albany, and we went to church there recently. And it had the same feel that St. Margaret's in Dorchester had when I was a kid. Sacred Heart in Tampa has the same feel. You can see people walking up, dressed quite well, walking up very much in a kind of a pomp and circumstance kind of vibe as they're going into church on a Sunday.
It's
parade day. So that and these are majestic buildings we're talking about here. So I grew up in a very beautiful church, and I still feel extremely comfortable in old churches, but I feel very uncomfortable in new churches.
Is your consigliere, your gangster, made kind of good but not really, Joe Coughlin, does he fear God?
He does. He does very much. In the church sequence, he looks around at everybody. And again, this is Joe. He's just detached and intelligent enough to say he wondered if Jesus were looking down at this community. When all the capos and all the hitmen who are out, arrayed in this parish, would he say, "You're missing the point"?
One would have to presume, yes. Dennis Lehane is with us. His latest novel is World Gone By. Behind us here, we've got the opening piece from Gone Baby Gone, composed by Harry Gregson Williams for Ben Affleck's 2007 film adaptation of that book of Dennis Lehane. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Dennis Lehane. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Behind me, the sound of a fictional gun battle on the streets of Baltimore, and from season 3 of HBO's The Wire, Dennis Lehane wrote the episode, Dead Soldiers. He's out with his latest, it is World Gone By. Crime fiction, elegantly written, really powerful, once again, gritty as always. He joins me in the studio today, and you can join us as well. Dennis Lehane also wrote the script for The Drop, which came out last fall as an adaptation of his short story, Animal Rescue. Here's a scene where the late James Gandolfini, in his final big screen appearance, plays Cousin Marv, a bitter old man who lost control of his bar when Chechen mobsters took over. Here he criticizes bartender Bob, played by Tom Hardy, for not doing more with his life.
Well, I'm not the guy that wasted his entire life waiting for it to start.
Why did that?
At least I had something once. I was respected. I was feared. When I walked into a place, people sat up. They sat up straight. They noticed. What'd you ever have? A bar stool that you put that old biddy at and bought her free drinks. And don't think I don't know that you did it on purpose. That was my stool, and nobody sat on that stool because it was Cousin Marv's stool, and that meant something.
James Gandolfini in The Drop, Dennis Lehane, how I miss him, the way he plays a role like that, unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah, it was astonishing. Yeah.
Were you on set for the filming of that, or was it all...
I was on set at certain days, but never any of the days that Jim was on. Yeah. We kept playing phone tag with each other, and then finally left each other notes that we'd see each other during the press. And then he passed away. So yeah. it's pretty tragic.
It
grew out of a short story. But I'll tell you something really cool about that. When we got down to casting, when they cast Tom Hardy, I went in and I cut 30% of his dialogue because Tom is such an expressive actor with his face. He thinks on screen better than any actor I've ever seen.
Doesn't need the words.
Doesn't need the words. And then when they cast James Gandolfini, I went back in and I added all this dialogue. Because I just wanted to hear what Gandolfini could do with some nuggets I had planned.
Wow, that's great. You know, I was with a buddy at a bar last night. Nice bar. He was paying and said I'd be talking to you today. And immediately, oh, I love Dennis Lehane. And he goes right to Coronado, collection of short stories.
Wow, okay.
Of yours.
Yeah.
Gritty, very gritty. Loves that gritty Dennis Lehane. But it's amazing how fast people go, wherever they're going to go. How did it happen? I mean, with The Drop, you start with a short story, different title,
yep.
Animal Rescue. It becomes a movie, and then I think you turn into a full-length novel.
I turned it into a full-length
novel. Of that name.
Yeah.
This is business.
Well, it was this story that just wouldn't end. It started as a novel, actually. It started as a novel in 2001. It kicked out on me. It's the only novel that ever did that.
Kicked out on you, meaning?
It collapsed. I just couldn't make it work as a novel.
Yeah.
And it was a novel with a lot of characters doing a lot of things. But the center of it was this guy who found this dog in the trash and how it made him come alive. And so then I rewrote that as a short story. And then that became a script. And then all of a sudden I said, wow, I think I finally
now
figured
I
out the novel.
All it took was James Gandolfini and Tom Hardy.
So, yeah. And also I got to reset the novel. We decided for a variety of reasons to shoot the film in Brooklyn. So I had to refashion the script as a Brooklyn script at the 11th hour. That was fine with me. But then when I got to write it as a novel, I got to take it back home. I got to set it in my fictitious neighborhood of Buckingham.
Yeah, that's terrific. Dennis Lehane's new book is World Gone By. Rick is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Rick, you're on the air with Dennis Lehane.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dennis. How are y'all doing?
Hey, Rick.
Well.
Doing good.
Well, I just wanted to tell you, Dennis, I'm actually on my way to go pick up World Gone By, and this radio program just happened to be playing. And my wife and I, for the last numerous years, read all of your detective series and like 3 times and have loved this journey into literary fiction that you have taken. And just curious as to how that transition worked for you as a writer, and was it scary, difficult, just your feelings on that?
I feel that what happened was I had always intended, again, I keep using this word, but to be an organic writer. I don't have much of a plan. I'm not good at that. So after Mystic River and Shutter Island, I had reached a sort of a level of fame that, to be quite frank, I wasn't terribly comfortable with.
Because?
I didn't like it.
You mean the, what, the people getting a piece of you, or
just a sense of no matter
exposure.
What I did, there were eyes on me. It was really weird. And so I just said, you know what? I'm what do I really want to write right now? Mm-hmm. And I said, I want to write that book about the police strike. And I knew it was going to be mammoth. And I knew it was going to take time. I didn't know it was going to take 5 years. I thought it was going to take three. So I just said, "This is here's your fork in the road.
The given day.
What type of career do you want to have?" Mm-hmm. And I said, I want to continue to have the career in which I am free to write what I want to write. And to do that, I went and I did The Given Day, knowing that it would probably cut my audience in certainly by a quarter.
Because?
Just because people want brands. The people who are extremely successful in the commercial fiction
stick
world,
with one.
They have a brand. You know what you're getting.
What was your brand before you took that fork in the road?
I think it was sort of a strictly urban crime novelist, mm-hmm. In Boston. Mm-hmm. That was it. Mm-hmm. And then once I broke away from that, and the fans who followed me are great. I mean, they're just fantastic. And I'm in a lovely sweet spot as a writer.
But The Given Day was still set in Boston. So was it the historical piece?
It was the latitude. Sense of sweep. It was the sense of there's no crime in The Given Day. Mm-hmm. There's no crime except the
police
the
strike and
eternal
society.
Battle between the haves and the have-nots, which is really what I write about the most.
Yeah.
So that's what led me down that path, and it's been something that I'm just exceptionally grateful for. It was very scary to do. At the time, I remember being like, oh, boy, I hope I'm right here. And if I'd had a wife and children, I'm not sure I would have made quite the same bet, mm-hmm. but I didn't. So I said, it's just me and my career. What kind of career do I want to have?
From The Given Day, went to Live by Night, and now we come to World Gone By. It's moved from 1919 to mid-World War II when this one opens in Tampa. Joe, in Dorchester, Massachusetts, Dennis Lehane's old stomping grounds. Joe, you're on the air with Dennis.
Hey, no, this is Joe Baker from the old neighborhood. How you doing?
I'm doing good, Joe. How you doing?
I'm all right. Listen, I always remember you as being a quiet observer to all the bedlam on the corner growing up. And is that where you got a lot of your stories from or ideas to grow on, number one? And number two, years ago, you did something very nice for my uncle when he was sick in the hospital, the disabled vet from the Vietnam War, Donald Baker, and you sent him over some books and signed them and all that. I wanted to thank you for that. But, we're proud of you here in the neighborhood. And is that what you were doing when you were watching all us crazy kids growing up? You get me a story.
Yeah, probably. I mean, when you think about it, it's a pretty standard writer's personality. You're kind of in the group, but not of it, if you will. You're there's always one eye watching everything. Mm-hmm. It's funny that you picked up on that, Joe. So yeah, probably at the end of the day, when I think about it, I always say I was blessed to grow up in an interesting place in an interesting time. That doesn't necessarily mean it was a safe place, but it was an interesting place in an interesting time.
What's the mark that Dorchester, that Boston imprint leaves on you as a writer? I read you somewhere saying you live in L.A. now, and people said, why are you so angry all the time? And you said, I'm not. I'm just from Boston.
Just from Boston.
For our non-Boston listeners, explain.
Well, Bostonians are, we're not really good at parsing our words. I mean, we say what we mean. Usually everything is right on our face, Mm-hmm. Sometimes people find that corrosive, or sometimes people find it abrasive. Mm-hmm. But it's that line in The Untouchables where Al Capone says, if you spit on the sidewalk, if you threaten me, I'm not going to blame you for spitting on the sidewalk. I'm gonna confront you for threatening me.
Yeah,
So
it's straight
that,
at it. Straight.
Yeah,
at it.
It's straight at it. And I don't know if a lot of places roll with that. And I come back to this, and as soon as I land in Boston, I see it, and I love it. And I don't care how long I'm in California. I'll be in California 30 years from now. Somebody will say, where are you from? I'll say, well, I'm from Boston. I live in California.
Joe, thank you very much for
thanks,
your call.
Joe.
And a special thanks to Dennis there for Joe's uncle Clay in Charlotte, North Carolina. Clay, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
I'm a Tampa native.
No.
And born and raised there, and just wanted to ask Dennis, your character in your latest novel, World Gone By, would it be by chance that it's based off the actual person called Charlie Wall of Tampa?
No, it's not based on Charlie. I did do some research on Charlie. I came across him. He was, I think Charlie was, I want to say almost more of a good time Charlie than Joe Coughlin. I think Joe is a little bit slicker. Joe's a little bit more removed. Where Charlie Wall was a big player in Ybor City in the 1920s. He was I could be wrong on this, but I believe he was ultimately killed in the Bolita Wars.
What were those?
The Bolita Wars were the most important thing to drive the engine of the criminal economy in Ybor City was the Bolita, which was playing the numbers. Mm-hmm. It was a form of the numbers game. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they fought a brutal – in fact, I'm sure of it now. Charlie Wall ultimately died in a brutal war over the Bolita Wars. Mm-hmm. And on the Bolita numbers. And it's suggested in this book, it's touched on it. I don't go hard on it. But it's also what ultimately led to the death of in this book, a gangster named Montooth Dix.
This is the big African-American gangster in World Gone By.
They wanted his numbers racket. Mm-hmm. And that was known as Bolita. Mm-hmm. So there's
your answer, Clay, and I appreciate your call. Our time's beginning to grow short here. Mary Grace in Hamden, Connecticut. Mary Grace, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
I really enjoyed Boardwalk Empire. It was excellent.
Oh, thanks.
And in that book, you also touched on Cuba at that time a little bit.
Well, in Live by Night, I touch on Cuba and Tampa. And I think when I got onto Boardwalk Empire, they thought,
let's use it.
Let's use it.
Also, children seem to be a theme in all your books. You know, in the end, it's the children that are most important.
Yes, and often most ultimately damaged by the decisions that the adults around them make. I think that's a really common theme in my work. I think I've identified after 12 novels the recurring themes that keep showing up. One is this idea of fathers and sons, mm-hmm. Over and over and over again. Examination of what that relationship
is. The legacy, what gets passed down, what doesn't, who's your family, where you plant yourself, where it's not.
Then the other question, the second off that sound of ancillary is, what is the definition of a family? Is it what you're born into or is it what you choose? And then third, over and over and over, is the sort of eternal rigged battle between the haves and the have-nots, I think is a constant in my work.
There's enough to work with there for lifetimes.
Exactly. I don't need anything. I'm good. I'm starting to feather mothers into my work now. It's still a parental issue.
Keep that palate rich. Children, definitely a big role in interesting ways in World Gone By, the new one. Mary Grace, thank you for your call. Mark in Waltham, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on with Dennis.
Hi. This is love both the show and your work, Dennis.
Oh, thank you, Mark.
I come to it through The Given Day. That was the thing that introduced me to you. So I don't come to it from the detective fiction initially. I came to it through the literary stuff.
Right.
And as I've been following it since, I find that as you deal with that book, class is front and center. And it's loud and it's proud and it's anxious. Mm-hmm. And as you go into the more recent stuff and your other work, that seems to dissolve a bit, and it becomes the haves and the have-nots. Do you think that's what's actually happened in our society, the class as a conscious kind of piece has dissolved? And what do you think of that as you do the work that you're doing now with the more current kinds of writing that you do?
Well, I do think that there's a foundational principle in America, and some people call it a foundational myth of the meritocracy. Mm. And if you believe in a meritocracy, then ultimately that means that questions of class and race have no place, because you're saying, hey, we're all in a meritocracy.
Work hard. If you're good enough,
you're gonna get
there.
Yep. Exactly. So I find that this is the best meritocracy I am aware of. But that does not mean it is a perfect meritocracy by any means, or that it's not rigged for certain people over other people. And so that's what I constantly am writing about. I think at some base level, what we call that a conversation about class or a conversation about race or a conversation about the haves and the have-nots, it stems from this feeling I had at a very young age watching the city tear itself apart during busing.
Boston.
That it came from this idea I had that I think the earliest complex thought I ever had was that it seemed to me in the best interest of the ruling class to keep the lower class fighting amongst itself.
And there it was.
There it was. Yeah. And that is something that I think filters. And I've never been dissuaded from that point of view. It doesn't dominate my life, but I think it dominates my fiction.
Let's get even more now. What do you see on the streets of Ferguson when you look at that? We just got a minute here. But in a nutshell, the Dennis Lane view.
Well, I see exactly that. I saw an amazingly corrupt system that was keeping people penned in and keeping people down and keeping people in debtors' prisons. And it finally all exploded. It finally came out, not just with the Michael Brown death, but with the reaction to the Michael Brown death. Yeah. You could see people saying, look, we have been quiet for too long. You've shut us out for too long. We are going to make some noise. And I respect that 100%.
And it's not over.
No.
Dennis Lehane, the new novel is World Gone By, third in a triptych. Started a century ago, nearly, in the streets of Boston. Now it's Tampa, right on down to Cuba. It's a great read. Dennis, thank you very much for coming in. Always good to see you. Thanks so much
for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, and James Ross. With help from Araz Havan and Caitlin O'Keefe, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.